If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm Steve Bertrand, and I'm very appreciative that you're here this week. Judy Blume is an American icon. Whether it's her children's books like Hello God, It's Me, Margaret, or her adult novels, including Wifey, or even her most recent efforts to fight book bans around the country, Judy Blume has been part of our literary fabric since the 1970s. And now she's the subject of a highly anticipated, wonderfully readable biography from Mark Oppenheimer. I've been lucky enough to talk with Judy a number of times, including here.
If there were a Judy Blume time capsule with room for one book, what would it be? And that's not a favorite book. I mean, I'm not asking about your favorite, but if there was one that sort of was maybe representative or one that you'd like to be known for, what would it be?
Well, I guess I already am known for it. And it's Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. Now you're going to make me cry.
Why would that make you cry?
I don't know, because I'm emotional. And, you know, thinking back.
You've said that's where you found your voice.
It is where I found my voice.
Her reaction to that very basic question, and one she's probably gotten hundreds of times, surprised me. We'll talk to Mark about that and get his reaction. Also on this edition, did you know that reading has become fashion chic? Coach is hoping so anyway. They're out with a $250 book charm line for their purses, their tabby purses. It helps the customers show off their literary side.
Yeah, they're readable. They are about the size. It looks like about a post-it. And yeah, it's definitely different. I don't, you know, I'm not sure, you know, some it's a signifier. I don't know that it's the most, the easiest way to read a book.
But we start with the biography of Judy Blume and its author, Mark Oppenheimer. Mark, welcome. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, it seems to me, and this might be a terrible analogy, but, you know, I live in Chicago, and you can walk by buildings in Chicago every day, and you know there's a history there. You sort of assign your own story to them, but you don't know the richness behind it. And it seems to me that that's kind of what we're talking about when we think of Judy Blume, right? We all have a notion, but there's a lot there that we don't know.
I think that's true. She's one of those public figures who, for people of a certain generation especially, just feels as if she's been around forever. It's hard to imagine a childhood, certainly as a reader, in the 70s or 80s or 90s without her. And she's also been quite gregarious and out there with the public. She's appeared a lot, so I think a lot of us can picture her, and we've heard her. We've heard her on talk shows, late night shows, you know, earlier years we'd hear on Oprah or Donahue. And she seems to have just always been like this older friend. But when you look at all the profiles that were written about her over the years, a lot of them rehashed the same stuff, and a lot of them were not really adding anything to our knowledge of her. So I do think, certainly speaking as her biographer, I learned an enormous amount about her in the process of writing this book.
I read somewhere that you read her books dozens of times.
There were three or four of them that I reread again and again between the ages of, say, 9 and 12. I certainly read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. And then again, Maybe I Won't, and Blubber and Deanie. Multiple times. And, you know, for Margaret, it certainly was dozens. Yeah. I mean, because I love to read, but I also just didn't like a lot of what they were pushing on me, especially as a boy. Everyone's always telling you to read fantasy novels, you know, go read Tolkien, go read C.S. Lewis. And I couldn't stand fantasy. And, you know, to this day, it's not that I haven't read some fantasy I've really enjoyed, but if you look at the canon of fantasy writers who are urged on young people, Tolkien, Lewis, Madeleine L'Engle, etc., Ursula Le Guin. These are writers whom I don't connect with, by and large.
It sounds to me like you're almost repeating her story, right? In that she loved to read as a kid, but didn't like the books that she was presented with and read a lot more adult fiction.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, she certainly did read, there were some young people's books that were very important to her. The Betsy Tacy books, for example. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, the Oz books were big for her. So she was conversant with the the young people's literature of the time, but she pretty precociously moved on to adult literature, in large part because that was the good stuff. I mean, a lot of young people's literature then and now was kind of Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys and these kind of squeaky clean, rosy-cheeked teenagers solving not-so-terrifying mysteries. And she thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be more fun to read John O'Hara or F. Scott Fitzgerald? And she was right.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the Betsy Tacy series. I didn't know it. I just interviewed a columnist in Minnesota a few weeks ago. She's making a great resurgence in the wake of the ICE crackdown in the Twin Cities, because she talked
really?
About going. Yeah, it's a fascinating story that, you know, she as a kid would go into these neighborhoods that were largely immigrant, coal workers, iron ore workers and things like that. So her stories, if you read them in the context of ICE, are all about inclusion in Minnesota.
They have a new resonance. That's really interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't know the Betsy Tacy books when I was growing up, but I married a woman who read them and adored them and has passed on that love of them to our children. So they're very much in my household, but they weren't part of my own canon. Like you, I somehow they passed me by when I was a kid. But there's a Betsy Tacy Society that celebrated her 100th birthday, the author's 100th birthday a few years ago. And I know that, yeah, the part of Minnesota that she's from, she is quite the local hero. I think you can go to her house. And so that was very formative for Judy. But yeah, she was going to leave a lot of that behind as soon as she was able to pull adult books off of her parents' shelves. And her parents were big readers and her aunt and uncle were big readers. There were, you know, these were not wealthy people. These were not people with advanced degrees in the humanities, but they were absolutely people who thought literature was part of the good life.
She started writing a memoir herself and set it aside. As a biographer, is that helpful or is that sort of an unwanted map, right? You want to find your own route to her life? Or tell me.
Oh, I mean, there's an easy, I understand why you asked that. One can imagine a scenario in which it was some sort of impediment or roadblock or psychological block, but quite to the contrary, she wrote, you know, I don't know if it was 10 or 20 pages, mostly handwritten. She typed up some of them, but then abandoned it and then handed it off to me and said, here's, you know, you do with this what you will. So some of the very important and interesting and moving scenes that I have in my book about her very early years, I'm talking ages, you know, 0 to 6, let's say, I got from her own reminiscences in her abandoned memoir. Mm. So it ended up being a real treat for me, a real resource.
Her parents were very different, right? Her father was the optimistic cheerleader, her mother not so much.
That's right. Her mother had a pretty nervous disposition, you know, was anxious, could be somewhat difficult. There was tension there all through their lives. And Essie lived into her 80s and was with Judy for most of her own adulthood. Whereas the dad, Rudy Sussman, was somebody whom Judy remembered with enormous fondness. He died shortly before Judy's wedding. She got married at the age of 21 before her senior year at NYU. And her dad didn't make it to the wedding. Several of his siblings had died quite young of massive heart attacks as well. And that proved to be his fate. It just kind of ran in his family that the men didn't make it to, you know, to age 60 or even 50. And so that was very hard for her. She really, really adored him. He did have a temper. I mean, there was a dark side to him. He was a dentist, and his secretary or nurse or hygienist would keep little plastic figurines in the office for him to pick up and throw against the wall and smash when he went into one of his rages, which I find a kind of extraordinary fact. It's something that that I don't think the people who knew him, including his children, thought of as one of his defining characteristics, because he was in so many ways so wonderful. But I do think that if you're looking honestly at her childhood, it's interesting and relevant that both of her parents dealt with, both of them had a dark side, perhaps unsurprising. They were, you know, they both had grown up without much money at a time when it was hard to be the children of immigrants, when it was hard to be Jewish. They lived with uncertainty and a lot of precarity in their lives. So they each had their demons.
I'm going to ask you one question about two men, and I'll ask about her father first. He died before she started published writing, and would her career have been different had he lived longer?
So It's a fascinating question. I tend to think that she would have found her way around to writing fiction eventually anyway, because her need for a creative outlet came out of her life as a housewife and mother who found herself with some time on her hands once her children were in school full time and wanted an outlet for her creative energy. And I think even had her father been alive, that still would have been true of her life, that she would have had an urge to be creative and to do something. Had her father lived, presumably when she was a young mom a few towns away in the Jersey suburbs, he still would have been a practicing dentist. I don't think he would have been there all the time or affected her daily conditions. I think she still would have been in the house looking for something to do. So, of course, it would have made a difference, because everything makes a difference. And having her father not die at a very young age would have been a huge difference for her. But I like to think that she still would have found her way to a writing career.
He died, just before her marriage. And that marriage was, it ended in divorce after several years. As I read the book, she was sort of dismissed by her husband, right? It wasn't an altogether happy marriage. So same question, second man. Had she been more happily married, would she have been a writer?
I think that's a more difficult question to answer. Because she did feel very alone in her marriage. He worked a lot. I wouldn't say they had a lot in common. He wanted her to take up golf or tennis so that they had more in common. He had a very, very close male friend going back to his army days who probably had more intimate conversations with him than Judy did. So that sense of loneliness of being in a marriage to someone who was not entirely simpatico really did spur her career. And if she and John had been real partners, if they'd had a really strong union, maybe her need to find work outside the home, to find more stuff to do, would have been different. I still think she would have ended up looking for work. She was inspired by the nascent second wave feminist movement, but perhaps the urgency would have been different. Perhaps she never would have begun going into New York to take night school classes at NYU a few years after graduating, and never found her way to that class on writing children's literature that ended up producing her first book. Her first book was begun as homework for a night class at NYU that she took because, you know, there wasn't so much to do with it with her or her husband back on the home front.
I mean, she had another outlet. She was creating these felt formations. Thank God maybe she set that aside and picked up the pen.
She was selling felt art on consignment through Bloomingdale's, where she would cut these pieces of felt out and glue them. And some of them were custom made and bespoke. You could get, if you had a baby or were buying a baby present for a new parent, you could have this little, you know, rectangular kind of wall hanging made with beautiful little felt pieces on it. They're pretty good, but I think we're all probably better off that Judy gave that up and turned to writing.
Let's just go to another man, significant man in her life. Her editor, when she discovered or when they found each other, Dick Jackson, right? That was a profound turn for her.
She had a few editors who really supported her. You know, later Carol Baron, who edited some of her adult fiction, was very important. But yeah, Dick Jackson, who acquired her. You know, one of her very first couple books, and then was the editor who really helped mold Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, which was her third book and her breakout success. And she just always found Dick to be patient and smart and understanding, and he knew how to edit her. You know, every writer is different. And, you know, so he, for example, understood that dialogue was a strength of hers, and he didn't mess with her dialogue. He kind of let it be. But he understood that sometimes structure was a weakness, and so he would help her restructure stuff. He also sometimes had insights into her characters that she didn't. There's a moment in Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, when one of Margaret's friends calls her and say, I got my period. And the editor, Dick Jackson, said to Judy, is her friend telling the truth or is she lying? And Judy then had the realization that the friend was lying to Margaret, that the friend hadn't gotten her period but wanted to have and was fibbing. And that was Dick Jackson's insight about this fictional character that Judy realized was a shrewd and correct insight that her editor had that she didn't. So they really had a mind meld that made her books much better.
You tell a great story when she gets reviews. And also, you know, this is great about the writing industry. This book is, because I learned so much about, you know, things change now, but how important reviews were, not to get just a good review, but to get a review.
Yeah.
And so in comes a review for Iggy's House. It uses the word effervescent. And here's Judy Blum, the icon, and Dick Jackson, the editor. And they can't figure out what the reviewer means. Is this good or bad?
Yeah, the word, so effervescent could have been the word. It was actually evanescent.
No,
that's important to the story because it's an even more obscure word. And evanescent means sort of fleeting or quickly vanishing or disappearing. And I think the quotation in question was, the reviewer was maybe saying this is better than many of the evanescent novels that'll be published this season or something like that. And they just couldn't figure out what it meant. And she always worried over her reviews. She would promise herself, I'm not going to read them. And then she would read them. And then there was at least one case where she sat down and wrote an extremely angry letter to the critic that she then never mailed, which was something she would do sometimes just to kind of get her feelings out on paper. I at one point quoted her in the book as having written a letter to somebody, and she had to point out to me later when she was giving me some corrections that she did write that letter, but she actually never sent that letter. Many of her letters she did mail, and she preserved a carbon copy for the archives. But in some cases, she would write the letter and then not mail it, and that told a different story about her life.
I want to ask this question. I'm not worried to fit it into the interview, so let's just go. You talk about when she's being profiled or written about or reviewed, the People magazine article in particular, where they often refer to her as attractive or her figure, right? It's mm-hmm. sort of these female slots yeah. that they can't escape, clearly it's important to you because you made a point of it over and over again. But so just to slip into misogyny, she does seem to be emotional, though. And I interviewed her once.
Yeah.
And I asked her the question that she must have been asked thousands of times. And it was, what book do you want to be remembered for? And obviously the answer is, Are You There, God? But she started to weep when I asked her. And, you know, you wrote scenes as well where she collapsed on a theater floor because she was so moved by a movie and things like that. And
yeah.
And I don't bring it up as a negative at all, but I just want to talk about that sort of her emotional level, where it was. How is she weepy?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think she's particularly weepy. I understand why you asked the question. I think it's a good question. I think that she is, first of all, in touch with her emotions. She's not somebody who stifles sadness or you know, she's not afraid of emotionality the way perhaps many people, many women, but certainly many men are. But she's also somebody who has candidly recorded in letters or elsewhere, or has talked about with me and other interviewers, a few very specific cases where she was very emotional, very sad, crying a lot. So when her second marriage was coming apart, you know, there was some weepiness, but that's human. I mean, that's to be expected. She does tell the story of having seen A Walk on the Moon, the great movie A Walk on the Moon, and which resonated so much with her own story of having been in a frustrating marriage in the 50s, early 60s, and how it spoke to her, and how when the movie ended, she just got down on the floor of the theater and cried. I don't think she's ever done that at another movie, to be fair. I think she's telling that story as a specific story to speak to how much she loved that movie, and she almost ended up working with that screenwriter on an adaptation of one of her own books, though it didn't come through, didn't happen. But, you know, I once finished watching a play and it was so moving that I just put my head down in my girlfriend's lap and started sobbing. That doesn't happen much, but I think part of it is that Judy is somebody who has, as a writer, perhaps successfully narrativized her life and remembers the highlights and the lowlights and writes about them and talks about them. So you hear about these times when she was very exhilarated or weepy, but I think she's actually a fairly, even keeled person for most of the time.
Yeah. And I asked the question, not as an accusation, but as an insight,
no.
You know, just to,
yeah.
I've talked to her a few times and you tell me, you talked to more people than I have, I think, in the writing world, but she always strikes me as someone who's actually talking to you. When you talk.
Yeah. No, she's very present. I mean, she's not somebody. I have interviewed people, as have you, I'm sure, who, having been interviewed so many times, get very cynical about it, and you really feel they're mailing it in.
Right.
I once interviewed some Hollywood star who was on some publicity tour, and, you know, he was so disdainful of the questions that I asked him. He wanted to make it so apparent that he'd heard these all 1,000 times before. I was asking nothing new or original. I was just a hopeless cliche as a reporter. And I've never forgotten that. And Judy is really the opposite. You know, Judy is somebody who I really do think works very hard to see everyone who encounters her as a human being in their own right. And okay. She always remembered stuff about me. And, you know, so, yeah, she's very present.
Mark, tell me the name of the celebrity and I'll tell you my story.
So here's the honest truth. I was searching my head for it because I would be absolutely happy to out them. And I can't remember who it was. It was male and in his 30s, and he wasn't super famous, right? It wasn't Ed Norton or Ben Affleck or whatever. It was a minor male actor from that era. And I've literally lost his name. But what's your story?
Yeah, mine is Harrison Ford.
Really?
He was in town. Yeah, I had the only one-on-one radio interview with him. And he didn't want to be there. And it was a movie that he was producing. Wow. And the interview was so bad. I mean, here I am with Harrison Ford,
right?
And the interview was so bad I couldn't use most of it.
Wow. But I mean, my example thing,
he seems completely different now. So I would love to meet him again and say, you know, are you happier now? Has your life changed? Because I think it's a different person.
Well, and people do grow and change. I mean, the great example of an interview that just was profoundly useless was, you know, I interviewed Senator Joe Lieberman several times. You know, he's from Connecticut. I'm from Connecticut. He was a Yale alumnus. So he lived near in New Haven, Stamford, that whole area. So when I was at Yale, he came through and I think I interviewed him once. I interviewed him once for when he was running for vice president. I interviewed him in retirement. Like he was around and lived near me and wasn't so hard to get. But his answers were always so predictable. He never went off script. He never showed anything original or different. I mean, he was a politician right. In the most boring way, you know, which was he just gave you the talking points again and again and again. It was really impossible to break through and get to any sense of the deeper self. I don't blame him for that. I understand why politicians do that, but it's one reason why they are boring interviews.
So we're here talking about Judy Blume though, right? I've lost track.
Yeah, we're talking about Judy Blume, another one of the great Jewish American figures.
One of the things that surprised me about her is that when they were casting, I think, the Margaret movie, and
yeah.
she said that she didn't care so much what the girl looked like because she didn't picture characters when she wrote the books.
Yeah.
That's hard for me to understand.
Yeah, she is not an incredibly visual writer. There are not long scenes of description of places. There's an exception would be starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, where I think we really get a sense of the beauty of post-war Miami Beach when it was still smaller, less built up, less rich, but very, very charming and idyllic. And you really can picture that milieu. But in general, if you try to picture, you know, Deanie's house or Blubber's school bus or any of their classrooms or even what they look like, you can't. I mean, I don't tend to remember what the characters look like because she doesn't describe them very well. It's not a strong interest of hers as a writer. She writes great dialogue. Ideas are a strong interest of hers. You know, Margaret's search for a meaningful religious life is very profound. But I'm not sure that we ever learn if her mother has brown hair or blonde hair, if her father's tall or short, et cetera, et cetera. So I think Judy's on to something about her own work there, which is that she is not a particularly visually oriented writer.
Late in her career, she spends a lot of time fighting the idea of banning books. And yeah. Her books are challenged often these days, but they weren't when they first came out. Did I read that correctly?
No. What happens is, you're almost correct on that. The truth is that challenges to books tend to be cyclical. So in the early 70s, mid 70s, there was not as much of an organized movement to get controversial books off of library shelves or out of school libraries as there would be 10 years later in the late 70s. Of course, what interceded was Jerry Falwell, The Moral Majority, the rise of the Christian right, and then, of course, the candidacy of Ronald Reagan giving a lot of fuel to that fire. So there were way more book challenges and more successful ones probably in 1980, 81, 82 than when Judy's books were coming out in 71, 72. And then things subside for a while. And then, of course, in the past 5 years or so, it's been like turbocharged again.
Right.
So it's not that her books changed or that she changed. It's that the culture at various points in time has a strong interest in so-called protecting kids from these books or those books. And then that kind of nanny state impulse recedes and goes away for a little while or is subdued for a little while, but then it always comes back.
Talk to me a little bit about the book Wifey. There were people close to her who suggested she not publish it at all. Right. And yet it seems to be the one that made her rich.
Yeah, Wifey was her first adult novel, her first of four adult novels. You could actually question whether Tiger Eyes and Forever are for, they're not for children. They're probably for sort of older teens, but they're not for adults. Wifey was an adult novel. It was about a woman, one might say, trapped in a difficult marriage, not an abusive one, not a horrible one, but a difficult one. Certainly based in part on Judy's own first marriage to John Bloom, though she wrote it when the marriage was already over. And it's has some very, very salacious sex scenes. You know, the main character ends up having affairs, pretty graphically described episodes of adultery. And it's, you know, it's not a book that I would give to my 12-year-old, and I give a lot of books to my 12-year-old, but 22-year-olds and 32-year-olds bought it. When it was in manuscript form, there were people who said to Judy, don't publish this or don't publish it under your name. You have such a wonderful reputation as a beloved writer for children. Even people who don't mind the controversial aspects of your children's books may turn against you when they read this book because the sex passages are just so much. And Judy, you know, forged ahead and said, no, I'm proud of this work and I'm proud to publish it under my own name. And people will have to understand that I write all different kinds of books. And the book, you know, got some good reviews, a lot of negative reviews, and then sold quite well. So, you know, all's well that ends well. But I went back and read it, and it's not a great book, but there are passages of it that are really wonderful satire that really capture something about this character's life and the people around her in a very funny and cutting way. As with all of her books, if you think it's about the sex or the body stuff, you're probably missing the really good stuff.
We talked earlier about the impact she had on young readers and the faith that young readers put on her. And with that came, you know, she's incredibly accessible. And so many of these young readers or adult readers reach out to her, and they reach out to her sometimes in times of crisis or deep trouble, which must be an incredible burden for her. And I know she tries to deal with it, but it's got to be overwhelming at times too.
She at one point sought therapy for this problem of not knowing or having a hard time drawing boundaries between herself and her readers, taking on too much of their problems. There were times when youthful correspondence would be writing to her and she would become attached to them through their correspondence. And then they might suggest that they were having suicidal thoughts and she would, you know, reach out to, you know, I'm thinking of one case where she reached out to a student's university and said, is this person getting healthcare? Are the deans aware of this child's difficulties? She would counsel young people on relationships they were in and say, it sounds like this person's not good for you. It sounds like this person is, you know, being emotionally difficult or abusive. Now there were thousands of these writers, and most of them she would write back to very briefly, or they would get a form letter, or they get a pamphlet or a signed photograph or whatever. She was not in deep correspondence with lots of them, but there were, you know, any number of them over the years whom she became really epistolary friends with and took on their troubles as her own.
Lori Kim.
Yeah.
I mean,
Lori Kim. Lori Kim's one of the great examples, and they're still in touch. And, you know, I think she went to Lori's Swarthmore graduation and I can't remember if she made it to Lori's wedding, but they really, you know, there are a few under 10, but there's a few who really became long-term acquaintances or friends.
Okay. So you're writing a book about a very famous writer. She helped you with the book, lots of interviews. She's read the book, I'm assuming.
She certainly read a draft of it because I wanted her to read a draft. And I always said that I was going to show her a draft because I knew she would catch some errors in it. And she really did. And that was a huge boon to the book. I don't know if she's read the, you know, then I made some changes in part as response to corrections she'd found and suggestions she'd made. And then there were other suggestions I didn't listen to and trusted my own judgment. And I don't know if she ever read the final copy of the book.
So do you have a sense that she's pleased with it, not pleased with it, or does that matter to you?
You know, first of all, I've always said that I will never speak for Judy. I quote Judy in the book when she has said on the record things that I can quote. And otherwise, if I don't know what she's thinking, I will never presume to know what she's thinking. You know, one person asked me, you know, what do you think she thinks about political question X, Y, or Z? I don't remember if it was the Middle East or whatever. And I said, I will never, ever, ever even hypothesize about what Judy's thinking because she's alive and well and living in Key West, and you should go ask her. So I don't know. And I don't hypothesize because people should talk to her. When you say, does it matter to me? Of course I selfishly want everyone to think well of my book, including, you know, of the 9 billion people in the world or whatever, 7 billion, I forget. Like, I want them all to buy it, hardcover, retail, and all of them to love it. And so I want that from her as well. But to the real question you're asking, look, the writer, the reporter, the journalist, the biographer works for the reader, not for the subject. And so this was something I had to think about constantly when I was writing my last book, which was about the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. I was writing about people who had been through a lot of trauma. They'd either survived the attack on the synagogue or maybe they lost loved ones, but, you know, people who in various ways were survivors or the relatives of victims and had a lot of feelings. And a lot of people said, are you showing it to them? Are you making sure that you're not re-traumatizing them? Are you getting their input? Are you collaborating? And I always said, look, I want to do right by people. I want to be fair to them. I don't want to blindside anyone. But at the end of the day, the audience I'm concerned about is the readers, not the subjects. And I think that's how it has to be.
Mark Oppenheimer is the author of Judy Blume, A Life. It concludes the biography by saying that every biographer needs to, or of necessity, leaves things out, just because of, as I recall, space or things like that. And that's certainly the case in this conversation. I could talk to you forever.
Thank you. Likewise.
I am one of the 7 billion who enjoyed the book very much, learned a lot, enjoyed your writing, and I do appreciate you joining us today.
Steve, thank you so much. It's been really good to be here.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Okay, so would you wear a book attached to a purse, your purse? Coach thinks so. In fact, their big marketing campaign this spring seems to be behind that. To help us understand it is Chris Kelly joining us from Marketing Dive. Chris, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Marketing Dive. What do you guys do?
Marketing Dive is a B2B publication focused on the marketing and advertising agency and how digital has changed all that.
Okay, so Coach announced this past week or so, this new campaign, Explore Your Story. The key on the story, right, that women in the Gen Z 14 to 29 are into reading. Reading is hip, which is great. And so Coach is banking on them buying these book charms. Explain them for me.
Sure thing. So, yes, as like you said, as part of this spring campaign, Explore Your Story, they have their tabby handbag and these book charms that attach their miniature books, you know, from the and they kind of they're pairing with different creators and ambassadors. But there's Sense and Sensibility, I Know Where the Caged Bird Sings, a couple other books that they you know, pulled from the community that they wanted to see as a charm.
Now, I don't really know. I don't come from the world of book charms. What are they in general?
So I don't either. The charms, you know, we're seeing this you know, in different apparel and retail categories, kind of ways to personalize things. So, you know, I think this is a first of its kind, you know, with Coach. But, you know, we see the charms on like on Crocs and other ways to kind of personalize stuff. So, yeah, they're kind of coming up with something new to personalize.
Well, new is when I think of a charm, I'm thinking of something that you –
of like not a croc, like a little disc you'd affix to your croc shoe or something like this. These are actual books, right?
Yeah, they're readable. They're about the size. It looks like about a a post-it. And yeah, it's definitely different. I don't, you know, I'm not sure, you know, some it's a signifier. I don't know that it's the most the easiest way to read a book at that size, but yeah, I think, you know, the fact that there's real interest around this was a big push for them.
So, and maybe that's what it's about, is the interest, but the idea is that I would buy, or my wife would buy one of their purses, that the Tabby purse, and then a Sense and Sensibility book charm, which is actually a book that hangs off the end of the purse.
That's the thing in here.
And they're doing it with, they're doing a big emphasis on this, right? They've got celebrities lined up, and this is going to be a big deal for them.
Yeah, no, this is their spring campaign, you know, and they did this kind of social first, as the jargon now in marketing, where this stuff is coming from the grassroots, coming from social media. But, you know, they had these out on the runway at Paris Fashion Week. They have got Ellie Fanning and Paige Buchers. And it's also a global campaign. They're doing things with different media companies, the US, China, and Japan.
So if I'm sitting on the bus going to work and I don't want to play with my phone, or maybe as an alternate to my phone, I could read a pint-sized version of While the Caged Bird Sings.
I think so, yeah, and I think that's also part of it is, you know, even though it's coming from social media, there is the pushback on, and we're seeing this across categories. We've seen this a lot with brands like Heineken, kind of pushing back on all the phone time and the screen time.
Digital, right. Do you know, and they said this is because reading is becoming hipper with the Gen Z generation. Do you know much about that?
You know, a little bit. It's not my demo, but I think, you know, there's on TikTok, you know, communities around, you know, book talk, and a lot of interest. You know, we've seen, you know, it's pushing kind of definitely romance genre, you know, just having these conversations and kind of getting back to books, but through social media.
Well, I mean, as a guy who pushes books and loves talking to writers, that's great to hear. I'm glad that books are hip again. You don't have any charms on your wallet, do you?
No charms and no, nothing book size. No.
What, if you were to have a book charm, what's your title? Do you have one?
Oh, geez. I'd find something small that maybe a Bret Easton Ellis, like a less than zero, something small that would fit, that would be readable on a book charm.
Well, be warned, if you see women of the age of 25, 29 walking around with a purse and a book hanging off of it, I'm not going to say they fell for it, but they're taking part in this new book charm move by Coach. Now, I sort of alluded to it earlier. Is this one of those things, you're a marketing guy, where it's more about the pub that they get with the announcement than actually selling the charms?
You know, for Coach, and I had spoken, you know, in an event with their CMO, you know, they really want to be, you know, build community around more than just selling bags, you know, and getting younger consumers. And they see this as, you know, I think it may be a smaller revenue driver, but for them, you know, really getting people kind of invested in the brand and staying with it beyond just the purchases.
Well, it's anytime a book is sold, that's a good thing. Chris Kelly with MarketingDive.com. I guess, right, MarketingDive.com is the best way to find you.
That's the one.
Listen, I appreciate you taking the time. I'm going to whip out my wallet here and start checking out Tale of Two Cities.
There you go. Thanks for having me, Steve.
That's going to wrap things up for this edition of Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm very glad you're listening, glad you're here, and I'd love to hear from you if you have a thought or comment, positive or, you know, negative, I guess. SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. That's my email, SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. Let me know what you're reading. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, be well.